It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen will be back next week. The New York Times broke a story this week based on interviews with current and former Obama administration officials concerning the president's handling of the war on terror. President Obama has not been shy about using America's drone fleet to attack and kill terrorists. In addition, there is apparently a secret kill list comprised of top terrorist targets. These revelations have sparked a discussion on the legality and ethics of war by assassination. Candidate Obama, back in 2008, promised to close the Guantanamo Bay prison and end the U.S. use of torture to obtain intelligence. Well, Gitmo is still open. This morning, we're going to talk about the Obama administration's prosecution of the war on terror, and we want to get your thoughts on the issues surrounding this. Let me tell you how to get in touch with us. The phone number is 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or a question there. I'm going to have two guests this hour. In the first part of the program, I'll be visiting with Micah Zenko, a fellow at the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of an article titled Where the Drones Are in Foreign Policy Magazine. Micah Zenko, good morning and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Happy to be here. Great to talk with you.
You describe the Times story as a blockbuster. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's never been anybody, Joe Becker and Scott Shane, the reporters who got 30 former and current intelligence and military and political officials to speak at such level of detail about the decision-making and the process by which individuals are added or subtracted from what are called kill lists used by Special Operations Command and the CIA to go out and target in foreign countries. So it really never provided the level of detail that we've seen, which is important given that these strikes have been going on outside of the battlefields of Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya since November 2002. It's been almost 10 years. We've had very little transparency into this, and that this article really gave us an insight that we hadn't seen before.
I was a little bit surprised that so many Obama administration insiders were willing to even speak about this, and it made me think that perhaps the president wanted this information known.
Yes, he did want it known, and in fact, in the last 6 to 8 months, there's been several efforts at being more transparent about U.S. targeted killing policy. The current senior counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, gave a famous speech at Harvard Law School. The council generals of the CIA and the Pentagon have both given speeches, and then Eric Holder, the attorney general, gave a speech which he sort of outlined the legal due process that supports U.S. targeted killings. And then, of course, about a month ago, John Brennan as well, for the first time ever, said that these strikes actually occur. It had been this sort of long-running myth that the United States could not acknowledge that these strikes happened because they were, quote, covert under U.S. law. Covert operations are those that do not, where the U.S. role cannot be acknowledged, right? So for about a month now, they've been trying to become a little more forthcoming. There's an author named Daniel Kleidman who has a book that's coming out that has many of the same features as the New York Times reporting. So clearly the signal went out from the White House that they want to sort of stage manage what they consider decision-making, what they consider transparency by selectively sending individuals out to meet with sort of key members of media.
Now, if I were a cynic, I would think that there was at least a little bit of a political motivation here. I mean, it's an election year, and the president is demonstrating that he's tough on terrorists.
Well, I mean, as I've always said, if you're a civilian official and you're elected political member, the most impressive and responsive tool in U.S. foreign policy is the military, and the most impressive and responsive and cost-free and precise tool are drone strikes or our offshore cruise missile strikes, which are the primary platforms being used for these attacks in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, and elsewhere. And so, yeah, it clearly is in President Obama's best interest to present the image of being tough on terrorism, and it's certainly one that they've run with. One of the more interesting features in the New York Times reporting was that in what they called the Terror Tuesday meetings, where individuals' names were being reviewed, whether or not they could be nominated for attempted killing, was that David Axelrod, who is President Obama's senior political advisor, was in the room for some of these meetings. Clearly, to present the or to project the notion that, you know, an election is coming up, and if there were accidents, if there was one, either a terrorist attack, which could be linked to people that the United States did not attempt to capture or kill, or if there was a targeted killing which led to a lot of civilian casualties, these would both be bad things for President Obama's reelection chances.
Now, the idea of having a list of high-value terrorist targets, a kill list, if you will, isn't new. The Bush administration had one, and they used drones to go after people on that list as well. What's different about the way that President Obama is prosecuting the global war on terror?
You're absolutely right. I mean, 6 days after September 11th, President Bush signed a number of memoranda of notification which authorized the CIA to target for death about 24 individuals. Most of these people were directly related to the 9/11 attacks or previous attacks against the United States abroad, such as the 1998 Africa embassy bombings. The big change in U.S. policy was in Pakistan. In the summer of 2008, the threats to the state of Pakistan, the threats to U.S. deployed soldiers and southern Afghanistan were escalating, and the United States, they had this tool, which were drones, some of which were flown out of Pakistan, some of which were flown out of Afghanistan, which were going after Taliban and, or I should say, suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants, was they, as the administration officials described it, they widened the aperture of people who could be targeted. So this is where the invention of what are called signature strikes occur. Now, a kill list is a name, is a list of names and people where there's intelligence where you can make some case that they're involved in terrorism. Signature strikes are people whose names we don't know, but who are, through what they call patterns of behavior, providing what administration officials determine is operational support to terrorist activity. So these are people who are driving individuals who might be involved in terrorist attack. These are people who live with them. These are people in a compound where they are located. These are people who might be seeing training with them. And the justification is that under U.S. law, if you provide operational support to a identified terrorist, you can also be targeted. So the aperture is really widened in the summer of 2008. And since then, the number of strikes in Pakistan increase, but they just escalate tremendously under President Obama. So where there were 33 drone attacks in Pakistan in 2008, in 2009 there were 53, in 2010 there were 118. And then what's really changed as well is beginning in December 2009, there has been this low-grade war that the United States has declared, or not declared, but is conducting against what's called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, located on Yemen. And so these are offshore naval strikes, these are drone strikes, and this is just increasing month after month after month. It's estimated that this month there will be, or in May, there will have been something like 35 U.S. airstrikes in Yemen. The most there ever were in Pakistan was around 20 in September 2010. So President Obama both has increased the number of strikes in Pakistan, expanded the number of airstrikes in Yemen, as well as a number of attacks sort of happening under the radar in Somalia.
The president, when Barack Obama became president, he had virtually no foreign policy experience, but he had to learn very quickly on the fly. And his own, it seems to me, just reading all the articles about this, that his own position on these things has, shall we say, evolved over the time that he's been in office. And it seems that he's been reluctant to use these so-called signature strikes, in some cases anyway. And he's made himself much more involved in the approval process of this whole thing. And the CIA has probably less autonomy than they did under the Bush administration. Would you say that that's a fair characterization?
No, because what the president did do is President Obama did allow signature strikes in Yemen. This is something the CIA had been asking for in the past. Again, this reporting is in lieu of any transparency or due process about how these decisions are actually made. I mean, we know more as Americans about how people can be captured in foreign countries who are connected to terrorism. We know more about whether how they can be interrogated. We know more about where they can be held, such as in Guantanamo Bay or a military brig in South Carolina, than we do know about how they can be killed. So this article and others like it sort of convey the notion that President Obama has a very tortured and conflicted idea about whether these strikes should be occurring. We don't necessarily know if that's the case, but it's clear that he feels some obligation to be more directly involved in people who are being targeted. But if you just look at the numbers of reported strikes, he is certainly letting loose, whether it's the military or the CIA, because in Yemen, some of them are done by the CIA, some of them are done by the military. In Pakistan, they're all done by the CIA. In Somalia, they're all done by the military. And it's, and I would add, it's hard to tell at times what is special operations forces from the military or the CIA in some of these, in some of these countries. But if you just look at the numbers, President Obama has certainly lowered the threshold for who can be targeted.
What about President Ford's 1976 executive order that basically says our intelligence services are not going to pursue a policy of assassination overseas? How does what we're doing now jive with that?
Well, the law, the Executive Order 11905, says no employee of the U.S. government shall engage in or conspire to engage in political assassination. So the distinction they make is that under the laws of armed conflict, under Article 51 of the U.N. Charter, the United States has an inherent right to self-defense. And as a result of 9/11, al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups, this is a careful distinction, but its affiliated groups created a state of war against the United States. And the United States has a right and an obligation to protect itself. And so the United States sees itself in a state of sort of perpetual war with no geographic boundaries and no necessarily defined end game, end state. And so this is how they get around it. Even before 9/11, in 1998, President Clinton actually issued some memorandum of understanding which authorized the CIA to kill bin Laden. So the right of three presidents in a row to conduct targeted killings has sort of sustained. The differences, obviously, under President Bush and then furthermore under President Obama, they've just become much, much more frequent occurrences.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got some callers who want to join the discussion. You could be one of them. There's a line available for you right now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. I'll be right back with more with my guest, Mike Azenko, and your calls. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 20 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about a New York Times article, which also, I believe there was a similar article in Newsweek. The Times broke a story based on interviews with current and former Obama administration officials concerning the president's handling of the war on terror. Specifically, we send a lot of drones out. We've been making a lot of drone strikes there. Of course, you have the killing of Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda has pretty much been decapitated in terms of its leadership. But there are some concerns about the way this is being carried out and some questions about whether or not it's even legal to do this. And we're discussing all of that this hour. My guest in this portion of the program is Mike Azenko, fellow at the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of an article titled Where the Drones Are in Foreign Policy magazine. We're going to go to phone calls in just a moment, but I wanted to ask you something about something I saw in your article. You talk about lawyers being stationed at an airbase the U.S. uses to launch drone strikes from Qatar 24 hours a day to approve the strikes carried out by the U.S. military. How does that work? The base commander or whoever is making the decisions over there has to talk to the lawyers before they send out the drones?
Well, it really depends on what the level of authorization there is. I mean, under it's really hard to know what the approval process was, but under the CIA operations, it used to be the director of operations, the deputy director of operations of the CIA could authorize certain strikes. When they occur from the military, it's likely that either perhaps the regional combatant commander or a special operations commander or the Secretary of Defense in some situation has to authorize specific. But the question is, once the individual's been authorized, then you have to do an assessment of what is the likely blast radius of where the missile lands, what is the latest updated intelligence about who's in the area, because if the blast radius is such that you're going to potentially kill civilians, you might have to get higher levels of authorization. And, you know, I've talked to people involved intimately in both the targeting side of this, the weapons side of this, the legal side of this. You know, they take their jobs very serious, and they do their utmost to limit the number of potential civilian casualties that occur. Most of the civilian casualties are not the result of the weapons itself, but it's a result of often bad intelligence. For the signature strikes, there's often more civilian casualties because they actually don't know the actual names of the people involved or how directly tied they are into them. But there are lawyers, trust me, at every level of this that require approval and sign-off.
One of the criticisms of the way this is being done now is how civilians are counted. One of these figures don't lie, but liars figure, that kind of thing, or at least that's the way it's being portrayed. There are a number of different ways to take a look at this, and the Obama administration has chosen the one that makes them look the best, apparently, and why wouldn't they? But what are? Can you explain a little bit about that, how we decide who's a civilian and who isn't?
It's very, very tricky. Somebody asked us 2 days ago, the spokesperson of the Pentagon, about civilian casualties, and he said, I can tell you that there are very, very few civilian casualties. And then the reporters say, well, what do you mean by very, very few? And he says, well, there are constraints about what I can say, but I won't get into it. John Brennan, who is the senior advisor, White House advisor for counterterrorism, at one time said there were no civilian deaths over a certain period of time. He said there were none. Another unnamed CIA official at one time said that there were 2,000 militants killed, 50 of whom were civilians, which means, you know, what, 2.5%, or you can do the math. Other people have said something like 3%. Other people have said up to 30%. You know, it all depends on what you consider being involved. The Associated Press did a really interesting on-the-ground reporting from Pakistan in the late 2011, where they visited the locations of the biggest drone strikes. And they went around and they just interviewed everyone on the ground after they occurred. Because, you know, what happens is the U.S. follows these people, these individuals for a long time with a number of manned and unmanned assets. They see them, they strike them, and then militants come, retrieve the bodies, and then they bury them, as is customary under Muslim law. They have to be buried by sundown. So nobody from the U.S. government, from the Pakistani military, goes and gets a DNA sample. They never know for sure who they are. And so what they do is they just monitor from above to try to really get a determination of who it is. But so the Associated Press did a similar thing, but they went and they were able to talk to the victims' families and others. And what they found was that 30% of the people killed in the largest CIA drone strikes in Pakistan were either civilians or members of the tribal police. So again, the estimates are somewhere between 2.5 to 30%. It all depends on how you count it. But the real story is nobody really knows how many civilians have been killed. And it's not clear to me that there's anyone within the U.S. government who is making a great effort to find out.
Let's go to the phones. We'll start in Madison. Chris is on the line with us. Chris, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Just a comment. It really kind of seems like with these drone attacks, we're basically told that, you know, there are these al-Qaeda terrorists all over the Middle East, and that they can essentially, you know, engage in these drone attacks under any pretext whatsoever without showing any real proof of who these people are. And another, just the other question I have is, I would appreciate your comment on specifically the drone attacks that had killed, I believe his name was al-Waliki or something along those lines, who is an American citizen, and just the president, the U.S. president, now feels that he can send in drone attacks to kill U.S. citizens without any sort of trial, any probable cause. And in addition to that, the National Defense Authorization Act that authorizes the president and the military to detain American citizens at home and abroad without charge or trial. And I just appreciate your comment on these other developments kind of related to presidential powers over the last few years.
Well, the Anwar al-Awlaki, who was a U.S. citizen born in New Mexico, he was he was essentially an imam in Virginia. He appeared on a lot of television shows after 9/11, trying to serve as a bridge between Islamic extremism in the United States. He was Yemeni sort of by nationality, and then eventually moves back to Yemen. And he is, according to U.S. officials, although again, you know, there's no evidence been provided, he was involved as a operational planner of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I've actually looked at all the statements by U.S. officials before he was killed and after, and before the fact, they sort of said he was a charismatic preacher, he was a very computer savvy, and afterward they describe him as being very operational. But it's very tricky because, you know, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution provides U.S. citizens with a right to a fair trial and a hearing, and Anwar al-Awlaki was not provided that. Whether or not he was operationally involved with al-Qaeda or not, I don't know, but the United States, the Office of the Legal Counsel of the White House, has apparently a 50-page memo, which is sitting in some vault, and members of Congress have tried to get them to declassify it, so they will state on the record what was the legal justification for the targeted killing of an American citizen abroad, but we don't know what it is. But if you ask anyone in the administration, they said that President Obama, all the way down, people were very comfortable with this target.
Chris, thanks for the call. Micah Zenko, we have to let you go because we're going to switch guests here, but I appreciate your being here and sharing your insights with us this morning.
It's great to talk. Happy to do it anytime.
Micah Zenko, fellow at the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of an article titled Where the Drones Are in Foreign Policy magazine. Joining me now is Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author whose books include The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, and The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. Well, good morning, Ron Suskind. Thanks for joining me this morning.
It's great to be here, as always.
What's your take on the New York Times story?
Well, I think it's a story that's been bubbling around in reporter circles for a while. Greg Craig, who was Obama's chief counsel, left after a year, if you'll recall, under cloudy circumstances. And ever since, people have said this is a dysfunctional situation when it comes to some of the ways that this president has decided to really drift from his statements during the campaign and exercise his executive powers. And it's interesting because, you know, what often happens at moments like this is that the messages that emerge from a White House, and clearly this is one that they, in some key ways, I think, helped encourage, they provided access, let's just say a complex calculus in a political season. I think part of what they're doing is wanting to show that this president is tough in ways that often Democrats are not given credit for, in a bit of a Nixon to China move. This president, is acting sort of like George W. Bush and then some when it comes to his desire to kill him wherever they are. And essentially exercise a new form of executive and American power. What's interesting is that this story shows a particular a complex movement that this government has taken away from some of the things this president was expected to do. You know, I reported in this last book of mine, Confidence Men, where I spent several years in and out of the West Wing, how this president arrives with an extraordinarily high approval rating. And, you know, when people were dancing in Kinshasa and Jakarta around the world, seeing this as a real sign of a new America, after a decade following 9/11, when we really drifted away from some of our moral anchors, our moral bearings. And what's interesting is there's a speech in June of 2009 in Cairo, which is an extraordinary speech. And if you go call it up on Google, you can see this president carrying forward a message that I think people thought would be at the center of his foreign policy as president, about how West and East need to work together, essentially carrying forward this notion of a hearts and minds struggle and of America returning to a kind of truth in its oaths, a kind of embrace of its traditional model of engagement. And then you had very little else after that. In fact, inside of the White House, the president was a bit piqued after that speech, saying there was no expression in policy after I gave this extraordinary speech in Cairo. And the fact is, there was no expression in terms of this hearts and minds struggle, as the New York Times story points out, all the way until September of 2011. That's just a few months ago, when Hillary Clinton, in fact, drove forward the idea that we really need a policy as to how America is going to engage with this wider world, rather than one that simply carries forward a model of force, force that is often carried out on little more than suspicion, which is really a carrying forward, frankly, of the Cheney Doctrine, the 1% Doctrine, which is the title of my other book, which is that essentially if there's a 1% chance that a terrorist will get their hands on WMD, which frankly Cheney and Bush broadened to a 1% chance that someone's a terrorist, we need to act with certainty. It's not about our analysis. It's about our action. It's about our response. And that's a model that this president has carried forward with a particular sharpness and pointedness and force, in fact. And I think that's what the Times story points out, letter and verse.
How much has this use of drones and other military tactics damaged President Obama's standing abroad?
Well, you know, I talk to lots of folks in the intelligence community, and there's surprisingly mixed reactions and discomfort with this, because what many of them realize, especially folks who deal in the area of human intelligence, which is really the gold standard for intelligence, it's not signal or electronic intelligence, it's the human stuff. People are complicated, and people can get intelligence and information, and if they work for you, as spies have done throughout history, they can give a president decision-making advantage to know what's coming, frankly, before the moment of crisis. And that human intelligence has been compromised almost indisputably because of this model of kill first and decide later whether those people were innocent, guilty, collateral damage, or high-value terrorists. And the fact is that the numbers, as I think your other guest pointed out, and many people have, are pretty disquieting as to the number of people who are slaughtered just being nearby one of these Predator drone Hellfire missile moments. It has undermined what we really, when Obama arrives, what many people are very hopeful about, and frankly, even George W. Bush felt at the end of his presidency, is that we are not getting the stuff we actually need strategically, which is human intelligence, cooperation from other countries, liaison services between government intelligence agencies. That's the stuff that helps keep America safe, much, much more than this enormous wide net of electronic intelligence, and electronic intelligence now, which is carrying the force of explosive might with the predators.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll take a call from Marilyn in Cleveland, Wisconsin.
Hello, Ron.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Marilyn.
I would like to ask, the Pakistani public is enraged by our drone attacks because we are disregarding their national sovereignty. How does the administration justify going and attacking countries that we have not declared war on? We are just disregarding their own wishes.
Yeah, well, Marilyn, you're right on the point here. The Pakistanis are livid about this. And look, the Pakistanis are a complex and contentious crowd at this point, and they are in many ways standing at cross purposes in terms of their agenda and our agenda with the United States. There's no doubt about that. But the fact of the matter is that for every moment in which we have to default, and it largely is a default, to saying if there's a reasonable suspicion and we have some intelligence. Now, if you understand intelligence, you know it's all areas of gray. It's all it's all, here's our best understanding. Is it hard to confirm? Yes. But here's what we know based on what we can gather. That's mostly what intelligence is. Unless it can be confirmed independently, it is not considered actionable intelligence. Almost all of the intelligence that's carrying forward in terms of the kill list, the targeting of people, does not meet that standard. And in their gut, people, of course, understand this. After one of these explosions occurs, you know, there's all manner of Pakistani outrage and press. Who are these people? There are profiles of them. You know, this is a child who was happening to walk by. These are people who just were maybe doing a favor for a friend. That has roiled the outrage in Pakistan and probably has caused a recruitment of many, many more people. That's at least the best understanding of the number of people we have killed. And the point of sovereignty is right on it. Just think about it this way, is that this the Predator technology and the missile technology essentially attached to a surveillance drone, which is what it is, you know, of course it's high-tech stuff, but it's not magic. This technology will undoubtedly fall into the hands of many other people, many other countries. Parts of it clearly already are. At which point they'll say, look, the United States is the world leader, has set the standard. What's to stop anyone from saying, guess what? You are a high-value target for our government. In Washington, D.C., walking down the street, a Saudi ambassador is a high-value target to the Iranians, let's say. You know, ostensibly someone walking a street in the United States or Britain could be a high-value target to some enemy nation. You know, this is a genie that is now out of the bottle, and because the United States essentially has presented the genie and has done it without parameters as to these issues of sovereignty, these issues of nation-to-nation force and diplomacy, of, hey, guess what, we have a problem, and we don't want to have to use this force, and what can you do, you Pakistanis, you Pakistani government? Because of that, we are unleashing, I think, a force that will come around to bite us. There is no doubt about it, because sovereignty of nations has been violated and will continue to be violated by these operations.
Marilyn, thanks for that call. Let's go to Mike in Appleton next.
Yeah,
hi, Mike.
Very quickly, a couple of questions. First of all, this report. How much information are we giving out about our methods and operations that, you know, is wise to do?
When I read this report, I see nothing in it that the folks at in ISI and Pakistani intelligence in Afghanistan don't already know. The fact is that there is nothing in this Times story that I think even gets close to the threshold of handing over cards that we hold in our hand in terms of that.
Mike, what was your second question?
Well, maybe it's not so much a question but more a comment. And I think it's striking the difference of President Obama candidate and President Obama president. I mean, the change is radical. I mean, more power to them. I think they should do it every day. You know, any enemy that we have, whether, you know, confirmed or suspected, should be taken out. But I think this is just striking. And I think the media's reaction, I mean, if it was Bush doing this, they'd be foaming at the mouth.
Well, I think that the media's reaction in terms of Bush and Obama is at this point in concert. I think that Obama did get a bit of a bye when he first got there because of some illusion, some things the White House presented, some of his personal a narrative, if you will, an aura was such that people needed to essentially be proved wrong about what they expected with Obama. And I think at this point they have been And it just it took the Fourth Estate, the press, a while to do it. But I think right now this story that's in the New York Times is very, very similar to stories that that I and others wrote about George W. Bush. It's about broader issues of America's role in the world and these principles that are actually at the core of our national self-identity. Some of them go back long before the founding of America, the notion of being able to face one's accusers in an open courtroom. Some of these principles go back to Hammurabi, the idea that that individuals are essentially innocent until proven guilty, of course, is at the core of what we call rule of law. The fact is many of these issues are not easy to transmit when you talk about going across borders and overseas. But I think that the thing that is most pointed about this story and others like it as to the difference between Obama the candidate and Obama the president is that the notion of America and its conversation with the world is in some ways right at the center of what often turns the wheel of history. You know, Dick Cheney, back when, at the start of this post-9/11 period, when there was a great deal of extra-legal activities going on in the United States, surveillance and whatnot of U.S. citizens, he basically said, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, you've got nothing to worry about. Well, that is precisely a standard that the founding fathers of this country said is not acceptable in the United States, because the decision of doing anything wrong is a decision made by a government, by those in power. In this country and in the principles that we push around the world as the oath of the United States, the notion is the people are sovereign. The officials are public servants, with all the tensions in that interesting phrase. Awesome power, but yet servants of the people. And I think the interesting moment now is you begin to understand that this message of you're okay as long as you don't do anything wrong, you got nothing to worry about, from Dick Cheney is now Barack Obama's offering to the rest of the world. If you're not doing anything wrong against the interests of the United States, well, you can go about your business. But whether or not that is the case, that will be our decision. And if we so decide, from on high, from some invisible place in the sky, wherever you live in the world, you could hear that high-pitched sort of whirr of a missile, and that's that. And I think that signature of U.S. power is not fitting with what has worked best across U.S. history in terms of the fundamental principles that the United States represents, which is at the core, in fact, of our power.
We need to take a break, and we've got some more callers that I want to make sure we get in before this hour ends. So let's do that right now, and then we'll come back. We're talking about how the Obama administration is prosecuting the so-called global war on terror and wondering what you think about it. Here's the number to call, still a couple of slots available, 800-486-8655. talk@WPR.org is the email address, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around after 10 o'clock this morning. We'll be talking about Greg Allman's autobiography, story of the Allman Brothers Band and his own journey from Florida and out to California and back to Macon, Georgia, and all over the place with the Allman Brothers. We'll talk about that book, and we'll hear some music after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about how the war on terror is being prosecuted by the Obama administration. Some concerns have been raised, to say the least, by a story that was broken by the New York Times this week regarding the use of, assassination and all the drone strikes that the United States is employing to go after would-be terrorists. And so we've been talking about that this hour. In this portion of the program, my guest is Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of a number of books. And before we went to the break, I was thinking If you're in a fight in a dark alley and you employ the Marcus of Queensberry rules, you're going to get your butt kicked and you might get killed. And some people have made that analogy in terms of how we need to prosecute the war on terror, that the old rules don't apply. And if we try to apply them, we're going to end up on the wrong end of things. And that's why we need to change tactics. We can't use the old rules, just no longer work because the other side isn't playing by them at all.
Well, you know, that's an argument I've heard many times, and it's not one without some validity. In fact, it's been one that we've had for many years in America. There's something I end one of my books with from George Kennan, one of the great foreign policy thinkers of the 20th century, where he at one point as a young man is looking across Hamburg at the end of World War II, and of course it's been destroyed, and tens of thousands of women and children were slaughtered. And he says, you know, if we are to have a reasonable claim to a higher moral departure point, we must learn to fight our wars, in fact, without having to create Hamburgs or Dresdens. And it's interesting because he says right there, he says, the generals I know say, you know, you're foolish to believe that you must fight with everything you've got or you'll go down to defeat. And he is quite pointed in responding that we must have a superiority of might sufficient that we don't have to resort to a set of means to get to the ends that obviously are ones that we approve and seek, such that we do not compromise this moral departure point, because he points out that that's actually the source of America's real power. It's not the armies assembled on borders. It's not even our economic might. It's the notion of these principles that carry forward the human pageant, the human journey, and human human sovereignty in ways that enliven the rest of the world. That, in fact, though, as I talk to folks in intelligence, they say that is what gets us people to do the things that is really most helpful. Our belief in those principles, trusting our oaths, as they say, shows that we do not view these principles as brittle and matters of convenience. In Al-Qaeda's writings, stuff that bin Laden and Zawahiri and others wrote, they said the whole goal here is to force us to show that these prized principles that have changed the world, born of America, are actually simply matters of convenience when power decides they can exercise them, or embrace them, and we're going to show power deciding it can't afford to. That's their goal. That's their strategic model, because they understand in some ways better than we here in America often do that that is the source of our real power and the source of success when it comes to the kind of intelligence that makes sure we know a plot hatching prior to toward the moment of crisis.
Let's say we've got full phone lines, and I'd like to get to as many of these calls as I can. I'm going to have to ask everybody to be a little brief. We'll start with Dan in Three Lakes. Dan, go
Thank
ahead.
You. I have this to say. If we need to decide whether we're talking about morality, practicality, or politics. If we're talking about morality, the answer is simple. Thou shalt not kill and turn the other cheek. If we're talking about practicality, we need to do what the generals have said about Dresden. You fight with all you have, but at the time of Dresden, we didn't have any drones. So if we're making an effort to use the implementation that we have with an attempt to minimize collateral damage against people who have organized themselves and stated that the objective of their organization is to eliminate us, there is nothing immoral about getting to them first.
There's nothing immoral about getting to our enemies and stopping them from bringing damage to the United States. There's no dispute about that in any quarter. The question is, are we carrying forward a model of U.S. power that often rests on little more than suspicion, rather than anything even resembling the standards of evidence that are often at the source of even effective warfare. The enemy in this case is diffuse. They are hidden in civilian populations. And the way in the past that we have managed that is with intelligence, is with liaison services, is with knowing where they are, with attacking them either on the ground or from the air, but doing it in a way that is more precise and more effective in so many fashions than a kind of scattershot that we are dealing with at this point. And the fact is that everyone wants it to work. No one doubts that. But the point is, what price are we paying for it to work? And is that price greater than the yield of this effectiveness?
Dan, thanks for the call. John in Milwaukee, you're next. John, good morning.
Hello?
John, are you there? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is Jeff.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
If they don't have enough intelligence that they're taking out targets that are not viable, that's totally against the rights. And are these even constitutional? Like, the wars aren't even constitutional. They're going against the Constitution for that. And how far is this going to go that, they're going to have 30,000 drones over the United States by 2020, I believe I read. And how far is it going to go with that if they're watching citizens and people? And what if they're targeting the wrong ones?
Well, the issue is this country is, in fact, founded on the notion of limited powers. That is at the center of our constitutional system, a notion of checks and balances, so no duly elected individual can make a decision of enormous portent on their own. They need to consult with others. They need to go to other bodies of government. They need to go through the various checks so that ultimately we have a country that is ruled by law and not by men. That's the standard. It goes back to John Locke and all the foundations of the country. What we have now, though, is the start of essentially an expression of power that does not fit with that, to be blunt. And the fact that at this point there's a 50-page analysis inside of the government as to the killing of an American citizen overseas, that has not been released, shows that, in fact, it's about power, not politics. It's not about party, Democrat or Republican. It's about power and its prerogatives. It will exercise them as long as it is able to. And without checks, which we really don't have now, that will continue.
We had an email from John who writes, President Obama did say in his election bid that he would go into Pakistan if he had confirmed intelligence about a specific terrorist. So why is everyone surprised when we did it?
Because he's doing it without confirmed intelligence of a specific terrorist. I mean, no one in any way would tell this president not to do, frankly, what Bill Clinton did when they thought they had bin Laden at a meeting, just before President Clinton left office, and they fired their Hellfire missiles and they missed the target. But what we're dealing with now is something that's actually quite different. Then we have a high value terrorist identified through very careful we collected intelligence, and we're going to move in a surgical strike. What we're doing now is much broader. It's essentially a war by other means model, where we are saying, this seems good enough, and what do we know, and how do we know it, and we will act.
Well, hang on a second. Does President Obama's training as a lawyer and career as a law professor influence his thinking? How does he resolve these apparent conflicts? And we're almost out of time.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt this president understands the push and shove of where the law stands and where they're right up to the very edge or even over the edge of what legal standards have allowed. I think part of it is that when you get to be president, you think about things in a new way. You can't imagine or predict that. This president couldn't really predict what that felt like, even though he's got an enormous predictive aptitudes as to what's up ahead. He's very good at that. No one can imagine what it's like to be in that lonely round room, the loneliest place in the world, some might say, and having to act, especially when you have around you skilled expert advisors saying, this is the way we've always done it here in the United States. This is the way we've been doing it since 9/11. And for you to back away from that might be difficult. Unless you have an alternative model, and especially in a very tendentious political environment where this president feels like he needs to show his toughness, I think that's an overlay that's not something we should discount.
Well, and ultimately, one thing everybody should know about President Obama by now is that he's a pragmatist.
No doubt. And you know, and it's interesting because I think that everybody was involved in painting their yearnings on Barack Obama at a time of real fear and crisis in the United States in 2008. That was almost unavoidable. He came from nowhere. He was a tabula rasa. He had virtually no experience on the global or even American public stage. That was part of his appeal, in fact. And he often would sort of demur, saying, hey, I'm a pragmatic guy. Don't mistake me for someone I'm not, but the fact is many people did.
And we'll have to leave it there, Ron Suskind. Thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning.
Oh, my pleasure.
Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The 1% Doctrine and The Price of Loyalty. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who also handled on-air production, and my thanks to them. Stick around. We'll have more after the news. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.